Good morning, this is AM, I'm Chris Uhlman. The Abbott government's under pressure to make changes to its foreign fighter bill. The proposed legislation makes it an offence to enter an area where a listed terrorist organisation is engaged in hostilities. But legal experts and a coalition of Muslim groups say it's unworkable. They argue it should be scrapped or amended to spell out how people can prove they have a legitimate reason for travel. Political correspondent Louise Yaxley reports.
Declaring an area a no-go zone has been heavily criticised in submissions to Parliament's Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security. The Human Rights Commission's submission recommends that section should not be passed in its current form. And a joint submission from groups including the Islamic Council of Queensland says it should be scrapped. The Council's President, Mohammed Yusuf, says if it stays, people need much more clarity.
We need to know that people who are going genuinely to meet family members don't get caught at the airport when they come back, having to explain, and you know that is really of major concern to us. Because it's not only families, because also you're talking about friends. You might have a genuine friend. To declare the area as a no-go zone is one thing, but we need a clear definition of the family members, because largely in the Muslim community, we have an extended family system where we're talking about, you know, a very large family. So you could be talking about a cousin of cousin so-and-so or friends. And so this is a bit vague at this point.
Professor Ben Saul from the University of Sydney says the declared areas criminalise conduct that isn't in itself harmful, violent or terrorist, and his submission calls it an unjustified restriction on the right to freedom of movement. The Human Rights Commission says if the no-go zones stay in the bill, then the list of legitimate reasons should be made as comprehensive as possible. Another controversial part of the bill is to make it easier to use evidence gathered in a foreign country. Mohammed Yusuf warns that that evidence could be too unreliable.
For instance, a person who is charged here and the evidence against him is used from evidence, say, obtained in Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq. Now, some of these regimes up there are corrupt. Some of the regimes where you find that the evidence obtained might not be obtained through the proper legal means, there could be coercion. Those sort of things are very worrying, that yes, when you have a situation where the evidence is obtained from overseas and then they are used in a court of law against the accused here. So we have very strongly objected to that.
The bill would also lower the bar for the Attorney General to give the security intelligence organisation ASIO a questioning warrant, which allows it to compel someone to give answers and produce records. ASIO's submission to the Parliamentary Committee says that proposed amendment will improve the effectiveness of the warrants as an intelligence collection tool. The government wants this foreign fighters bill through Parliament quickly. The joint committee examining it is due to report by the end of next week.
Political correspondent Louise Yaxley. Most Australian paediatricians believe mandatory detention of asylum-seeker children is child abuse. That's the conclusion of new research published in the Medical Journal of Australia today. The survey also showed doctors had a poor knowledge of health screening and the eligibility of the children for Medicare services. Leave Caspin reports.
As of the 31st of August this year, there were 869 children in Australian immigration detention facilities and offshore processing centres. Now, in a study of Australian paediatricians about their knowledge of refugees and asylum seekers, there's been this conclusion.
What we found was that most paediatricians felt that putting children, asylum seeker children, in mandatory detention constituted child abuse. That's 80% of paediatricians felt that was the case, because to imprison anyone without a trial indefinitely is abusive, but to do it to a child in particular is even more sinister.
Paediatrician Professor David Isaacs from the Children's Hospital at Westmead in Sydney carried out the research. 139 paediatricians took part and were also quizzed on what they knew about the rights and needs of asylum seeker children.
Their knowledge was average, I would say, no better than that. Paediatricians don't always know that asylum seekers seeking emergency hospital care are exempt from any payments, at least in New South Wales and in most states, so they might not give them adequate health care because they were afraid they would have to pay for it. They're not very aware of interpreter services, and they're not very aware about Medicare availability and how to find out about Medicare for whether the patients are eligible and whether they've actually got Medicare cards and so on.
Fellow paediatrician Professor Elizabeth Elliott from the University of Sydney agrees some of the results are worrying.
Well, I think what this study indicates is that paediatricians need to be educated about the rights of asylum seekers who are on temporary visas and that they do have the right of access to Medicare and that they can be referred for specialist services.
Professor Elliott recently travelled with the Human Rights Commission to Christmas Island to look at the impact of forced detention of children on their health, including their mental health. She agrees with the survey that detention can equate to child abuse.
If we're depriving children of their right to education, to freedom, and to adequate and optimal, in fact, health care, then this is a form of abuse. And I think that what we saw on Christmas Island was many children and young adults who had extreme mental distress as a result of their prolonged period in detention.
The paper, which has been published today, calls for the immediate release of all children from detention.
Leave Caspin with that report. And AM has contacted the Office of Immigration Minister Scott Morrison. It's yet to respond. You're listening to AM Around Australia at 16 minutes past 7. And stay with us because ahead, Pope Francis has called a rare meeting of bishops and lay Catholics to debate contentious moral issues like divorce, contraception and homosexuality. Hong Kong's pro-democracy protesters have refused to clear the streets, despite being ordered to do so by this morning. They're angry at China's plans to vet candidates for the 2017 election and have been occupying key streets in the city for a week. The central government offices were closed by the roadblocks on Friday, and the administration wants them open today. And it says it will take all necessary actions to restore social order. Reporter Sarah Clark is in Hong Kong. Sarah, the government called on people to clear the streets, but they haven't.
No, Chris, they haven't. There are still a few thousand people at the main demonstration site in central Hong Kong with the road blockade. On the other side of the government building, which is the main access point for vehicles and for staff, that's also still blocked. There were some suggestions last night that they might clear that. But this is a clear, this is a deadline that CY Lung, the Hong Kong chief executive, has made his point, appealing to students to leave by the deadline, which was Monday. Now, with most people expected to return to work around 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning here, that doesn't look like it's going to happen. So we're waiting to see what sort of force is used to clear those students away.
What are people telling you?
Look, people are telling me that they're still going to stay here. There were talks overnight. Now, those talks were informal meetings and they were hoping to kind of move the situation along. Those talks, they didn't agree on either side. There were some three senior government officials and some student leaders. They failed to agree on three key principles. And those three key principles were that the talks would have to be ongoing, not a single meeting, and that both sides were equal and the government would execute the outcome of that meeting. Now, those talks failed to address that. So it's ongoing.
And university leaders have weighed in, issuing a statement?
Yeah, more than 80 academics from eight universities released a press release at about midnight last night urging the government to respond to the student appeals for concrete actions. Now, other academics have indicated that it's time to leave the streets. They said that the students' democratic aspirations are understood, but the demos have caused disruption. And the concern now may be that these students will be in danger.
The government wanted the streets cleared in time to get to public service workers back to work this morning. So are there concerns there might be clashes if that deadline isn't met?
Well, there could certainly be some violent confrontations if that does happen. I mean, again, there's been appeals to leave, but they're not going anywhere. Some schools have resumed. The high schools are resuming around Central, Wong Chai and Causeway Bay. But the primary schools are still closed, which is also causing a lot of frustration for not just the residents, but for school kids. Some traffic has been, or the roads have been cleared, but still the main site, which is now on its seventh day or eighth day of a blockade, it still remains closed.
And Sarah, the violence that we did see, was that inspired by criminal gangs?
Certainly, there have been suggestions that there were definitely links with the criminal group, the Triads here, and they were violent confrontations. And again, there were more on Saturday night and again yesterday, that the indication was that these people were being paid about 500 Hong Kong each, which is about 80 Australian dollars, to go in, create violence and create havoc here. And also yesterday, or late yesterday, there was a fellow who stood on the bridge on the walkway in the main demonstration site threatening to jump. This caused chaos. He was threatening to suicide. Now, the suggestions again that he was actually a stuntman and being paid to come in here and create more chaos at a relatively peaceful demonstration site.
That was reporter Sarah Clark in Hong Kong. More than 200,000 Indians have volunteered to go to Iraq and Syria to protect Shia shrines from being destroyed by Islamic State militants. India is home to 200 million Muslims. The majority are Sunni, but there is a large Shia minority. Many have been horrified by videos of Islamic State blowing up mosques and torturing civilians and are now hoping to help their brethren, even if it means sacrificing their own lives. South Asia correspondent Stephanie March reports.
Outside this Shia mosque in New Delhi, the walls are covered with huge posters calling for volunteers to save holy shrines in Iraq. Swinging on a stair railing next to one of the posters is 12-year-old Tatia Fatma. Tatia is tiny, and in a black and white sequined headscarf, she looks like a happy child. But even she has been touched by what's going on in Iraq and Syria. They're killing our people, she says. They're killing all those who are going for the holy pilgrimage. I want to go there. I want to kill them, she says. Tatia is talking about Islamic State militants. Like many of the devotees at this mosque, she wants to go to Iraq and help. Tatia says, I also want to be of some use by serving water, serving food, helping those who are in need of hospitalisation, assisting them. These are the kinds of things I'd like to do, she says. Volunteer coordinator Bilal Hussein says he's received 200,000 applications from people keen to go to Iraq. His target is 1 million. He says helping people is their first priority.
These would be all people with some technical knowledge. You know, people from medical background, from people from engineering and people from different walks of life.
What about active resistance in terms of defending shrines and defending areas?
We would form a human chain there in front of the shrines, right? And if they want to just desecrate the shrine, they have to go through us first. When they kill us, then they can, you know, desecrate the shrine. Then we will not let that happen.
Abbas Naqvi will be one of the first to go. He's been issued with an Iraqi visa and says he's not scared at the prospect of becoming a human shield.
If anybody will die there,
he says if anybody would die, then that person will consider themselves the lucky and blessed one whose life went in sacrifice for the protection of these shrines. There's growing concern that the Islamic State group is making inroads in South Asia. Over the weekend, the Pakistani Taliban pledged their allegiance to the Middle Eastern militants, and there have been unconfirmed reports that men brandishing IS flags have killed and beheaded people in Afghanistan's east in recent weeks. This is Stephanie March in New Delhi, reporting for AM.
The populist UK Independence Party could be about to make history. The anti-immigration, anti-European Union Party is likely to win its first elected seat at Westminster later this week when a former Conservative MP who defected to it stands in a by-election. That's a worry for the governing Conservatives who fear UKIP could split the right of centre vote, ruining the Tories' chances of re-election. The election is being held at Clacton-on-Sea in Essex, from where Europe correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
There's something quintessentially English about Clacton-on-Sea. Fairground rides still line the pier. There's ice cream to be had, whatever the weather. And if you've had enough of the seafront, there's always the amusement arcades. But the golden days of towns like these lie far in the past. Tim Bale is Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University, London.
It's got a lot of what are sometimes referred to as left behind voters. Voters for whom globalisation has not necessarily been good news and who feel resentful. So it's not the land that time forgot, but it's certainly a particular kind of constituency where you would expect UKIP to do well.
It's in Clacton that UKIP is hoping to gain its first foothold at Westminster.
Where would you like me to come and put them up? Okay.
Douglas Carswell is standing in the by-election for the party.
I think the Conservative Party that I've been a member of all my adult life is not serious. They make promises purely with an eye to clinging on to office. People in this country have had enough of a remote, unaccountable elite of arrogant politicians in Westminster telling us how to live our lives. Enough of it.
UKIP are where often described as loonies, fruitcakes, are they?
Established parties who feel threatened, they like to imply that we're somehow off the wall. That's because they feel threatened.
Douglas Carswell has very good chances of winning in Clacton. People here are receptive to UKIP's tough line on immigration, the European Union and the political establishment. Among its supporters, even immigrants themselves.
I'm French, but I've been here 25 years. I never claim any benefit, nothing. But you've got people coming from some European Union. They arrive on, you know, by plane, and the day after, they're allowed all the benefit and give them free houses, everything.
George Pigott says he hasn't voted in more than 50 years, but he'll go to the polls this week and he'll back UKIP.
It's the first step in changing what is the old-fashioned system of three or four parties dominating, and it's a very, very unfair country. I'm happy that I'm on the way out. I wouldn't like to be on the way in because it's frightening. Somebody has got to wake up. Let's start off fresh. Like you do in a new house.
UKIP is led by the charismatic Nigel Farage.
I don't think anyone would want to entrust the keys to number 10 Downing Street or the kind of nuclear button to Nigel Farage. On the other hand, he's an extremely skilled political operator. I mean, this guy is a populist par excellence.
He might not yet have the keys to Downing Street, but Nigel Farage and his party are now knocking at the door. This is Barbara Miller reporting for AM.
Pope Francis is gently shaking the foundations of the Catholic Church. He's called a rare gathering of bishops and lay Catholics in Rome to debate the Church's attitudes on contentious moral issues like divorce, contraception and homosexuality. The extraordinary synod is just the third such meeting in modern times. It could lead to profound change, and as it began, the Pope called on bishops not to place intolerable moral burdens on believers. Europe correspondent Mary Geeran reports.
In his Mass at St Peter's Basilica to open the extraordinary synod, Pope Francis had a few telling words of advice for bishops in the congregation. He told them, synod assemblies are not meant to discuss beautiful and clever ideas or to see who's more intelligent, a reference perhaps to the tone of recent clerical quarrelling. High-profile cardinals engaged in rare public arguments, in particular about Catholic divorcees receiving communion. But it's a taste of what many predict will be a wider showdown between conservatives and reformists behind closed doors over the next fortnight, and may determine the pontiff's own ultimate legacy. The Pope himself has let loose the dissenting voices, issuing questionnaires to Catholics on explosive issues such as contraception and gay sex in the lead-up to the synod.
The Pope is not afraid of this. He wants debate, as long as it's respectful, but he wants it to be real debate.
Robert Mickens is editor-in-chief of Global Pulse magazine and a long-time Vatican analyst. He says this promises to be a wild departure from usual synods, criticised even by bishops as exercises in rubber stamping.
This is something totally new, and it's the first time, I think, in at least 35 years, that a Pope has given the bishops permission to question, to probe, to disagree publicly with one another.
Robert Mickens says the Pope will be hoping this synod, like the landmark Second Vatican Council, kicks off a revitalizing period of debate, exciting some, alarming others.
There are more conservative members of the Church, including the bishops, that are very, very nervous. They, I believe, are anxious that things could get too chaotic and too out of control if we just debate everything, if we bring up too many questions. Because, let's face it, from the time of John Paul II, there was no questioning of the Church's teaching and practice on human sexuality, marriage and family life, priesthood. He cut off debate. So I think that's why a lot of people are nervous. They're just not used to having an open debate in this church. And that, I think, is something that's a real novelty.
An even larger meeting next year will determine if these debates lead to sea change or status quo. This is Mary Geeran for AM.
On the financial markets, the dollar is buying 86.76 US cents. That's down 0.81 on Friday's close. And 95.16 Japanese yen, down 0.27, 69.34 euro cents. West Texas Intermediate crude oil is selling at $89.74 US a barrel. I'm Chris Yulman, and that is AM for today.